Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 12:43 p.m. that is Pacific Standard Time, and today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes, and today is February 5th. Well, I thought we'd kick off with the Nasdaq because it's been a spectacularly impressive bull market for the last 12 years. And one thing that has been one of the primary consistency characteristics of the trend has been the tendency of the index to find support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average, which corresponds with 40 months, or 200 weeks, or the 40-month moving average. And it's bounced from that region during medium-term corrections on successive occasions since at least 2010. And it was a pretty good measure of what to look for or where to anticipate some support coming through in the big bull market up from the 1980s as well. Now, this is, let's not forget, a log scale chart. So when we see acceleration on a log scale chart, well, then we really have evidence that prices are going up a lot quicker than they would normally do in percentage terms. So the Nasdaq's appreciation has definitely accelerated over the course of the last 10 months. It went from lows below 7,000 to around 13,500 today, so that's a doubling in the space of less than a year. Then consider what happened in the period up from the lows in 1998. Let's just, for the sake of argument, think that the price found support around 1,000. It peaked at around 5,000. So it went up five times. That's considerably more than a doubling. And of course, if we were to think about what that would mean today, well, it would mean a price level for the Nasdaq 100 of about 35,000, which is extraordinarily high. But nobody is predicting that at the current stage because we don't have the evidence yet that we're going to have continued monetary stimulus. It's also worth considering that the valuation on the wider market today is quite a bit higher than it was back in 1998. When we think about what happened then, well, we had long-term capital management go bust, we had the Russian debt default, but the wider economy was in probably better condition. What we have right now is very high valuations, and valuations have increased over the last year, but that's also because of the economic contraction. And PEs generally do tend to rise during economic contractions because the earnings part falls faster than the price part, and then the price part recovers quicker than the earnings part. And that then creates the high PE after the worst of the crisis is finished. It takes time for earnings to recover. So we've had some really quite impressive earnings this week. And Google in particular came out with strong earnings, so did Apple. So the biggest companies in the world are still firing on all cylinders, and that's really positive for an index like the Nasdaq, considering that just taking the top five companies together, they have market caps in excess of $5 trillion. So $5 trillion, even in today's inflated dollar environment, is still a lot of money. Well, it does also mean that because they represent such extraordinarily high weightings, that their ability to outperform the index is going to be rather impaired. Then that suggests that there will be outperformance from other sectors. Even within a bull market, there's likely to be others that will perform better than the biggest cap companies. It's worth also considering that while Amazon is technically considered consumer discretionary, and Apple would probably also be consumer discretionary, then they're not exactly tech companies. But the one thing that they all share has been this clear benefit from the evolution of 4G and broadband. The fact that Facebook really wouldn't exist were it not for mobile. They made some of the best use of mobile broadband, and they were able to garner well in excess of 1 billion customers as a result. Then when we think about Apple, well then supplying those 4G enabling devices did very well for them. For Microsoft, adopting the subscription business model and moving more into cloud services, which then access is granted via broadband, has also been the abiding characteristic. So if we then think about the fact that Amazon and its complete reliance on cloud services, which then accessing them through broadband and 4G is vital to that entire business model. The cloud services business is entirely dependent on broadband. And then when we think about Alphabet, well, the ability to serve ads via people's phones and via search engines and broadband and mobile, it's all exactly the same. So they are all linked through broadband. And that's a well-understood market. So when we then think about some of the cloud computing ETFs, well, then we can probably start to think about, well, those are well understood. And this market continues to trend higher as well. And it's been still in a very consistent trend. So this remains a really quite powerful bull market, and until we see a clear source of inconsistency, then we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside, because the digitization of the economy got a massive leg up in 2020. Are they going to be able to repeat their growth in 2021? I think it's probably unlikely, but will they hold on to the gains that they were able to achieve in 2020, that's probably quite likely. So we've had an acceleration in terms of technological adoption as a result of the coronavirus. There are a lot more people now are comfortable working from home. And more importantly than that, companies are comfortable with people working at home. They understand what kinds of functions can actually benefit from people having control of their own time and which can't. Of course, one thing, I know it's a bugbear of mine, I have never had a Zoom call which has been of high quality. I was on another one this morning and it was patchy, and people's the connection is bad. It takes time for everyone to come online, and Zoom Media just seems to me to be a second-rate provider of these conferencing facilities. But the share is at least pausing here, and it looks more like a consolidation than a peak. I would say RingCentral is actually a better service overall. Any of the Ring calls I've been on have been seamless, and the consistency of their trend, that definitely helps to illustrate that it's a company that can actually deliver the product that they're selling. If one had to think about, which company is likely to survive when interest rates do eventually start to push back up, and total demand for video conferencing from the school sector abates, well, RingCentral is probably a better bet than Zoom. Peloton came out with impressive earnings for the fourth quarter as well this week. It had a $1 billion quarter, so that's about 500,000 orders for a $2,000 bike or treadmill, and they're having trouble fulfilling that. They weren't particularly rewarded with a positive push on the upside because they're having trouble fulfilling the orders, and obviously, everybody is questioning whether those orders will still be there when it comes time that they can fulfill them as people move back into normal life. And then when we think about the biotechnology sector, well, this is the other side of what happened last year. Biotechnology was one of the go-go sectors in the 1990s. There were enormous promises about the capabilities of the new biotech companies, and the big promise was personalized medicine. And we still don't have personalized medicine 20 years later, but at least today it's a lot closer than it was back then. And we have to think that the human genome wasn't first sequenced until the early 2000s. So perhaps this entire bull market in the 1990s was in fact pricing in the potential for what we're seeing today, the realization of that promise that genomics and gene therapies will reshape the healthcare system. Because all of 2020 was this massive proof of concept experiment for genetic sequencing and genetic solutions to chronic conditions. So if we can come through the next year without any real problems in terms of the side effects of the vaccines that have been produced for the COVID-19 epidemic, well, that is going to be an incredible validation for the biotech sector overall. And when we think about the kinds of innovation that are happening, considering the fact that it's less than 20 years since the genome was actually sequenced, and that we've now successfully taken something that would normally take 3 years, and listening to Moderna, they actually had their vaccine ready within 2 days of receiving the genetic material from China. And it took the next 10 months for them to get manufacturing capabilities and to go through the trial process. But they actually had the solution within 2 days versus what was previously 3 years. So as we think about what the potential is, well, one of the big innovations that we've had, and it's another example of shortening of time horizons, well, it's in Illumina. Now, Illumina is a very cyclical company, so it's prone to ranging, and it probably is best to look at it on a log scale chart. Well, if we then think about why is it so cyclical, well, it's simple enough. They bring out one, they announce that they're going to bring out a new machine, and then they bring it out. So then the sales peak, and then they start to go sideways until they bring out their next machine. And then they brought out a machine in 2017 and 18, and it is by far the leader in its sector. But then they don't have a new source of additional sales until they come up with something new. Well, the something new was something that they have, in fact, acquired, and it's liquid biopsies. So liquid biopsies are really difficult because as you take in a blood sample, blood is filled with all manner of different bits and pieces from around the body. And the various things that are floating around in the bloodstream make trying to identify cancerous cells extraordinarily difficult. But with the application of deep learning and then just massive computing power, it's now possible to just simply take a blood sample and screen it for various cancers. So that's completely new. And if we think about what the normal course of action is for diagnosing cancer, well, they have to go off and hope that it is a solid cancer, and that then all of the therapies that have been or that we're familiar with are aimed at solid cancers, and they go off and they find a big mass and they try to take a piece out of it, and then they decide whether it is cancerous or benign. But you have to know that it's there before you can find it. And then, of course, you're hoping that it's still reasonably small and that it can be operated on before it becomes a problem or that it, before it metastasizes. But if you have liquid biopsies, well, then you can do it a lot faster. It means that early identification of issues becomes much more possible. Then With early identification, early treatment means that survivability rates and the overall cost of treating patients will decrease as well. And we need to come up with ways of handling the cost of cancer care, because it's well in excess of $1 trillion a year. And as we think about the rising cost of healthcare and what that means, particularly in terms of treating the increasingly large elderly population where the majority of cancers arise, well, coming up with attractive solutions that both work and are cheaper represents the kind of catalyst that will pop or result in the next pop on the upside until they come up with their next innovation. But the other point, of course, is that with the potential to create tailored, tailored solutions to existing problems, that's the proof of concept that we've had this year. It was the promise that was the animating factor behind the big bull market in the 1990s. But this is perhaps the biggest lesson. Bull markets make incredible promises, and they get everybody excited. But they don't perhaps they then deliver on those promises, but perhaps not in the same amount of time that people would like it to happen. So if we think about the promises that are being made in this bull market, well, we can think about autonomous vehicles. It's pretty inevitable that we're going to have autonomous vehicles, because the potential reward is really quite profound. When we think about the fact that, say, in coastal cities around major ports, about 15% of workforces tend to be focused on driving. Well, if those drivers can be done away with, the cost of transportation declines. I've also seen that the first drone deliveries for various delivery companies were performed in the last couple of weeks. So we are definitely going to see more drones. And that also represents a significant cost saving. Of course, if we're going to see more drones, that means more batteries. And one thing that looks increasingly likely is that we're seeing a significant transition in terms of the transportation sector. So that's an additional point that is worth considering. Now, of course, in today's big picture review, I'm focusing more on the technology sector, because that's where we have evidence of well-established bull markets. Of course, there are other bull markets that are evolving where they're only really just beginning to break out now. And when I wrote the review of the big picture themes for today's comment of the day, I took it the other way around. I do think that both opportunities represent equal value, because technological innovation is something that is blue sky. So we don't have enough of evidence to support it based on historical precedent. The only way that we can come up with an historical precedent is to look at how other technologies have improved our lives or transitioned our lives in the past. When we think about what's happening in the healthcare sector, there's both push and pull. So technology is creating these incredible solutions. There's a lot of money to be made from them, so they are going to become part of our lives. And the cost is also coming down, so it means that they'll be more available to more people, and that will then create a market. So that's really quite impressive. Then when we think about the other side of this equation, and my daughter is reading this book on economics at the moment. She's on her school's academic decathlon team, and because I have the job I have, she was given the book A Little History of Economics, where she's going to be tested on it in the at the competition in a few weeks' time. We were reading the chapter yesterday on creative destruction, and it basically focuses on Schumpeter. One thing that I thought was particularly interesting was that Schumpeter was championing the ability of entrepreneurs to enhance the economy and to greatly, just through their force of nature and their intellect, to be able to create whole new industries and economic growth out of nowhere. That's the abiding characteristic of the technology sector. It's all about somebody coming out with a brand new idea and reshaping the economy beyond recognition. But what he also was very clear in stating was that capitalism would eventually face some very significant challenges, because while we tend to celebrate success, there are always going to be people who begrudge the entrepreneurs of their success. There are lots of people in universities who feel that they are smarter than the entrepreneur, and just question, why is it that they're not receiving the same just rewards for their work? And they then adopt a more miserly attitude and think about, are they then support more socialistic tendencies and policies? Well, he was incredibly accurate in that prediction, because we can see that the education sector has become progressively more dominated by socialism and censorship of ideas. And this, of course, represents the push and pull, because the economy completely relies on this the success of entrepreneurs to create whole new ways of doing things and enhance the social and the human experience overall. But then, of course, there's the question of the people who get left behind, and those people don't just disappear. And what we are seeing in the wider world today is that all those people who have been discomfited, the question that my daughter asked me just two nights ago was, why are so many people anti-capitalist? And it's a really great question. But if we then think about the personal experience of people, because I remember back in the 1990s that there in the EU, growing up in Ireland, there was talk about the butter mountains and the wine lakes and the massive agricultural production of the European Union. And by the time we got around to the early 2000s, it was gone, because it was deemed to be unfair for the wider world. So both the USA and Europe removed subsidies for agricultural products. And the result, of course, was that prices rose and production migrated to the new cheapest areas of production. Well, that was particularly beneficial for Brazil, and Brazil has been one of the biggest beneficiaries of that change in terms of the overall environment. Prior to about the early 2000s, agricultural prices had been range-bound. After the early 2000s, they rallied and are now in a higher price point overall. So that also removed a lot of farmers from the global environment. If we think about what happened elsewhere in 2000, China was brought into the World Trade Organization. Well, I've met people whose job it was to come to places like Europe and the USA and to buy up paper mills. And I know one person in particular. His job in the early 2000s was to go around Sweden and Finland and to buy the machinery out of paper mills that were going bust and just ship the entire factory back to China. And that resulted in a about 6 million manufacturing jobs in the USA and about the same number in Europe migrating to China. And those people were also left behind. So then we can think about the credit crisis. The foreclosure crisis resulted in it's really millions of people losing their homes. When we think about the fact that in 2009 and 10, it was 350,000 people a month were losing their homes, and that that had been trending higher in a really quite abrupt manner for years previously. So there were literally millions of people were thrown out of their homes. Many of those people might also have are known people who lost jobs in manufacturing, and it represented a massive hole in the middle class. Well, for those people, capitalism is obviously not working. They are being, and every one of those reasons is to do with government decisions. One was to try and improve the lot of the people overseas. The second was to try and bring China into the fold of the OECD, and that has clearly failed. And then the other was as a result of nobody seems to think anymore, but one of the reasons why we had the housing bubble in the USA was because of government policies to try and give people homes. And the relaxing of credit conditions to enhance the ability of poor people to get on the housing ladder was one of the reasons why we had that big pop on the upside against a background of low interest rates and then the financial engineering that came with that. Well, all of those reasons were government-led. So it was in fact both efforts by governments to enhance the lives of people overseas and then enhance the lives of people at home led to the hollowing out of the middle classes. And then when we add to that the continuing drive of technology, because one thing that has been particularly clear in Los Angeles is as the minimum wage has risen, the number of people working in McDonald's has decreased in an inverse fashion. Now, as you go into the McDonald's outlet, there is a touch screen, whereas there was always somebody previously at the counter. Now there's nobody at the counter. You make your order at the touch screen and then you just go collect your order. So to a greater or lesser extent, they have been able to do away with the counter staff. It's not so difficult to think that within the next 10 or 15 years, there might be nobody working in the McDonald's restaurants, and that the entire process could be automated, or that they could have the number of employees that they have. There is certainly still likely to be demand for fatty, sugary foods. There's that's pretty much a given. But the method through which it is delivered is something that is going to persist. Now, if we think about the logical progression of technology, obviously there is a lot of anticipation right now around autonomous vehicles, and we will eventually get them. Whether that happens in the near term or it takes another decade, the reality is that it's pretty much baked in that it's going to happen eventually, and that will represent another very significant change. But it's probably unlikely to be the only change. There are two additional evolutions that are happening right now that are probably going to be more momentous, because even if we think about autonomous vehicles are still going to need to be serviced. They're still going to need to be charged, and they're still going to be loaded, and they will need products. So there will need to be service people and technically proficient people in order to deal with them. Obviously, there will probably be less delivery people, but there'll be more warehouse staff. There'll be more kinds of warehouse jobs, although the warehouse itself is also going to become progressively more automated. Well, then the other point is that what about when computers increasingly can program themselves? That's something that is now happening. And the pace with which it's happening continues to accelerate. It's accelerating in an exponential fashion. It didn't really exist at all 5 years ago. It's possible now for computers to write articles and to create websites. But as we progress further along, then the ability of computers to optimize code will become progressively more important. And that will greatly enhance the pace of innovation. It's very much like how the pace of robotics is improving and artificial intelligence. Because an artificial intelligence system only needs to learn a lesson once. It doesn't matter how long it takes to learn that lesson, it only needs to learn the lesson once. And then it can improve upon that. Whereas every individual human needs to be taught the same lesson, and every individual new human needs to learn a skill, and every new employee that's brought online needs to be then trained. Well, that's incredibly inefficient when you only need to teach an artificial intelligence program once. So then obviously there is going to be a lot more digitization of the economy. Anything that can be made digital will be made digital because of the desire to do away with unnecessary workers. That, of course, creates social tensions. We are on the cusp of those social tensions now. We're definitely seeing plenty of evidence for it. And it's particularly evident in the countries that were most badly hit from the credit crisis to begin with, but then also the migration of manufacturing jobs. The one thing that nobody talks about is that manufacturing jobs pay well and generally pay about 40% more than the low-end service businesses that are where the majority of jobs had come from over the course of the last 20 years. The fact that all those people were viewed as expendable and not considered essential workers has obviously been brought home to them during 2020. But then we also have the evolution of quantum computing. And according to Google, at least, they were in 2019 progressing at an exponential rate. And that's incredibly profound. That's something faster than anything we've seen before. Now, the thing about, I think it's clear that quantum computing is the activation of the kind of philosophy that came out of Joseph Leibniz, and he was thinking about the best of all possible worlds. His view was rooted in theology, but the rationale that he used is, I think, directly comparable to what we see now in quantum computing. His conclusion was simple, that this world is the best of all possible worlds because it exists. And if we think about then the use of multiple possible world theory in quantum computing, well, the most perfect of all possible worlds is different from any other because it does, in fact, exist in this reality. And predicting which is the most likely scenario to arrive at existence is where quantum computing excels. So it's a probability-based way of looking at markets. It's a line of best fit from disparate pieces of information to the existing reality, or the reality that's due to exist in the near term. Now, that kind of way of thinking, well, it creates a new way of looking at programming capacity. And the one thing that I find particularly interesting about Google is that its autonomous vehicles and its ability with artificial intelligence and the success of DeepMind in the protein folding problem is really profound. They've been able to come up with the most accurate rendition of the protein folding problem in record time for something that generally takes years, considering the fact that there are millions of potential proteins and the number of protein structures that we actually have intimate knowledge of numbers in the thousands. So being able to solve that problem, it is something that could have a multiplying effect on our abilities to come up with new compounds, to come up with new solutions in the materials sector or in the life sciences sector. And that's not in the price at all. Their autonomous vehicles aren't really in the price at all, and neither is their quantum computing. If Google were to list those individual businesses as separate listings, then they would be of a scale similar to SpaceX or Airbnb, and yet you're getting it all for the what is essentially the price of their advertising business, which is on 30 times PE. Now, when we look at Tesla's valuation, it's on an estimated PE of 215. So every single potential innovation that Tesla has promised is already in the price. If we're thinking about where valuations are really rather extraordinary, well, we don't have to look very far. But then, of course, this brings us to the question of valuation and the potential, because obviously there are incredible things happening in the technology sector. But then we've also seen that some themes have already been heavily priced in. That's particularly true for Tesla. One thing that it should bring us back to question is that incredible move that we saw in biotech in the 1990s. One of the few companies that has still exists from that time is Bristol-Myers Squibb. And they bought up many of the companies that eventually went bust. But it still hasn't taken out its 1990 peak. Now let's think about Tesla, because we don't yet have autonomous vehicles, but Tesla has largely priced them in. Then when we think about the platinum-palladium ratio, I think this is one of the most interesting developments we've seen, because platinum underperformed palladium all the way down from the peak in 2010. So back in 2010, platinum was five times and more the price of palladium, and today it's less than half the price of palladium. So it's been an incredible reversal for platinum and an incredible bull market for palladium. Well, palladium is its primary use case is in catalytic converters, and platinum, the sector that the platinum miners have been trying to promote for the last decade is hydrogen fuel cells. Well, as we look at where the world is heading and the government decisions to try and create a new income stream and a new taxation regime around carbon credits, then they're going to tax anyone who's an emitter, but they're also helping to support a transition away from fossil fuels and anything with emissions. So the platinum-palladium ratio is a graphic representation of that. If there is less demand for catalytic converters because cars are increasingly going to be either electric or hybrid electric, or there we're going to see more hydrogen fuel cells, then there'll be more demand for platinum coming off a very low base and less demand for palladium coming off of an incredible high. And the ratio is still at really extraordinarily low levels. The other way of thinking about it is to think about the copper oil ratio. And we don't have quite the same, I think, in compelling trend here. Oil prices continue to recover, so it is coming off the lows. The incredible volatility that we've seen in oil prices over the course of this year, or the last 12 months, makes it rather difficult to graph it relative to anything else, because this incredible spike is something that is being unwound by the oil price in the short term. In many respects, oil today is trading on the same terms as coal did approximately a decade ago. There is this clear belief that nobody's going to be using oil anymore in 5 years' time. But the reality is that we're using it today, and we're going to be using it tomorrow as well. And that is still giving it the potential to rally. Now, of course, we haven't had a lot of investment in new supply, particularly in the shale properties, because the price is too low when they want to be able to hedge out future production if they're going to engage in drilling again. I think one of the things that is less well understood by people is that the great innovation of shale is that it is supply elastic. Or perhaps the better question is that it's demand elastic. When demand rises, then it can increase production. All it needs is to be able to lock in a price for future production, and they will drill. And when they drill, they will get the supply that's required. So that's, I think, one of the most important factors, that oil prices above $80 are going to be difficult to sustain, because there will be a significant supply response. Now, as we think about all that supply that's economic above $100, and there is a lot of supply that is economic above $100, particularly in the pre-salt in Brazil, well, that could quite easily get locked in. And it could be another decade before we see a significant move sustained above $100. Nonetheless, the price continues to push higher. But the potential is that the supply and elasticity argument is much more relevant today for copper than it is for oil. Copper is really very firm, and it continues to hold this $3.50 area. Copper has been a vital part of the global economy forever. But what we're now seeing is that it is increasingly required in electricity generation and in transportation. So these are two significant new use cases for the copper, for copper overall. We're also seeing that lithium is starting to recover, and it has now clearly broken its downtrend and is still pushing higher from really quite depressed levels. Some of the efficacy for this continued demand for battery metals got an additional boost over the last couple of days, with cobalt breaking on the upside. It had been in this base formation for 2 years, and it just took off in the last few sessions. And then, of course, we have nickel. The purity of nickel required for batteries is much higher than it is for stainless steel production. So nickel sulfide is a rare commodity. Now, when we think about some of the producers, well, Sherritt, for example, had this incredible bear market, and it went from 10 to almost zero because of its supply getting shot in Cuba. Well, with a new administration more friendly to Cuba, the price is starting to recover once more. Of course, the biggest producer of nickel is Norilsk Nickel, and that is now pushing on to new recovery highs as well. And we can think about the fact that it hit a peak back in 2007, and it's really right on the cusp of pushing on the upside as well. The additional point, of course, is that the higher nickel prices go, the more palladium that will be produced, because palladium is a byproduct of nickel production. And that is something that could result in this really quite incredible advance we've seen in palladium over the course of the last few years running into trouble, although it did bounce in here today. Well, if we can think about long-term trends, well, long-term trends evolve from long-term bases. And we've seen a large number of long-term bases being completed in just the last few months. So the Nikkei has completed a first step above its base, and the Topics Index is really not all that far away from its all-time peak either. It hasn't quite yet broken up, but it does look likely that that is going to happen. Taiwan was high beta Japan in the 1980s. It has also now clearly broken up and out of this very lengthy range. When we think about South Korea, it also ranged for a prolonged period, and it has clearly broken on the upside. The emerging markets ETF has also now broken out on the upside. It's been ranging for 13 years. If we look at Europe as a total, including the UK and the Swiss and Norwegian and Swedish markets, it's also been going sideways now for 20 years. And it's coming back up towards the upper side of its range. The FTSE 100 had broken out, then it came back down into the range, but it's firming once more. The FTSE 250 has obviously been a better performer overall. One thing that we can also think about in terms of these longer term trends, anything that trends for a prolonged period, they do tend to find support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. So that is something to pay attention to when we do get periods of pause and consolidation. Now, the big question, of course, is are we in a period of time where the rest of the economy is finally starting to play catch-up with the impressive bull markets that we've had on Wall Street, or is something else underway? Well, we may be, and this, of course, is this is a monthly chart. So rather than 200 months, let's look at 40 months. If we look at 40 months, then we get clear evidence of support being found and only a two-week dip below that 40-month moving average back in March. Now, there is the potential that the rest of the world is finally starting to catch up after nearly a decade on the upside for Wall Street. Alternatively, we're starting to see some rotation, and the outperformance of small caps relative to extremely large caps has really only just begun, and small caps are beginning to rally on a relative basis from the lows that were put in for the ratio back in 2000. So obviously there was a big acceleration in that downtrend in 2020. It's unwinding now. It's probably not, we're not going to have evidence that the trend has in fact been broken until it's back above 0.2. That might take a while, but it's certainly support here. Now, what this really suggests is that We're just at the beginning of a transition, and it might yet take time, but that there is clear scope here that other asset classes are going to do better than at the mega cap shares on the NASDAQ 100, and particularly the extremely highly valued companies like Tesla. When we then think about, well, what could be the animating factor behind that transition? Well, it's quite easily more about the debt load in the USA, because this looks like a completed base formation on the 10-year Treasury yield. And it's increasingly likely that we're going to push through that 1.2% level. There is this incredible amount of debt. The US government ran a 15 to 20% deficit last year. They're likely to run an equally large one this year. They have no plan for how they're going to unwind the generous unemployment benefits. They don't know how on earth they're going to allow foreclosures to start again. They don't know how they're going to work out the repayment schedules on mortgages where people simply haven't been paying. So they're just hoping that it's all going to get better when the economy recovers after the pandemic. Every 200 basis point move higher in the 10-year yield adds $100 billion per annum to the servicing cost of the US government's debt. And that's more money than they spend on education. So when we think about what that means in terms of government finances, well, there's only two things they can do. They're either going to have to raise taxes in order to close that budget deficit, or they're going to print the money. And that does look to be the most likely scenario. They're just going to print the money. And that raises the potential that the dollar is going to continue to decline. So the dollar index has certainly had a rebound over the last 2 weeks. And it's bouncing from the lower side of the range that's been forming for the last 5 years. But the big point is that the dollar tends to have 7-year bull and bear markets, and you get a bit of messing around in between. Well, we've had a big move on the upside from 2008 through to 2016-17. So that was a long one. Or we could say that the real bull market didn't start until 2011. And so then you get your 6 to 7 year bull market, and we've had the messing around. Well, it looks to me at least that this doesn't look like anything other than some steadying from a short-term oversold condition, and that the medium-term outlook is that the dollar will break down and that it will move to a new low on the dollar index. And perhaps the best way to monitor that is with the Bloomberg Dollar Index, because it has more of a weighting in other currencies other than the euro. Because the problem with thinking the euro is going to appreciate a lot is that Europe doesn't want it. They were willing to tolerate a stronger euro in the early 2000s because they were worried that it would fail. So they're not worried about the euro failing any longer. But what they are worried about is trying to pay back all of their own debts. So we are in a period of competitive currency devaluation. Well, this period right now where the dollar has been steadying has obviously weighed on the precious metal markets, and gold has been in a corrective phase now since August. Well, the one thing that we know, anyone who has been trading gold for any period of time knows, that it's volatile. And it is quite capable of pulling back and frustrating investors. And in the big run-up from 2001 to 2011, there were periods where it went sideways for up to 18 months. And the one defining characteristic was that when it popped on the upside, then It had the potential to do really well, but more often than not, those pops on the upside failed. We saw another example of that in just the last week. So the best thing to do for anyone who wants to be invested in precious metals is to look to buy the dips and to run the breakouts with the position that was accumulated during the dips. Buying the breakouts, it will work occasionally, and when it works phenomenally well, because you can see even following periods where the price goes sideways for a year, then it popped on the upside in very meaningful ways, which is exactly what we had in that run-up from August of 2018 to the peak in August of 2020. It was a two-year, really incredible advance that took us out to new highs. This really doesn't look like anything other than a pause in a secular bull market. And we're in the region of the 200-day moving average. And the 200-day moving average is a logical area where we might anticipate some support starting to come through. And at least at the moment, the $1,800 level is holding. Now, I'm prepared to see gold pulling back below $1,800 because it has a history of frustrating the bulls. And what, of course, that also fosters is the same thing we see in lots of other bull markets, that buy and hold eventually becomes the only mantra that works. We're still in a trader's environment in gold. There are still people that are very worried about the downside potential. We definitely see that it's still a fickle market. And people get really enthused when it's doing well, and they become overly bearish when it's not. But the reality is that governments don't have a plan for how to close deficits. They have restive populations who are ticked off with government intervention and are ticked off with lower standards of living. And there is just no way they're going to stand for higher taxes. So we're in a period of modern monetary theory. We have abundant evidence of that. Central banks have printed money on a one-for-one basis compared to the amount of money that governments have been printing. That's particularly true in the UK and the USA. And it's not going to end anytime soon. So that is likely to stoke inflationary pressures. And that is what it is designed to do. The one thing that we have on this occasion that we did not have in 2008 is a healthy banking sector. And the number of letters that I've received in the last month asking me to take out a loan or inviting me in for a financial health checkup to get me to invest in whatever products they have. I've even had a couple. It was one from JP Morgan offering me $2,000 for an additional for fresh money invested into the account. I think they were asking for $250,000 to be invested, and if that stayed in the account for 3 months, they'd offer $2,000. So they're definitely eager to accumulate reserves and deposits, so they do anticipate lending against that. I got, I think it wasn't quite the same call for deposits. It was a lower figure. I think it was $25,000 from HSBC, and they were offering $500 as a signing bonus. So these are clearly efforts by banks around the world to try and accommodate what they see as the potential for significant credit growth. So we're in the early stages of a new inflationary cycle. In the early stages of a cycle, wages rise, economic activity improves, and everyone thinks it's a wonderful idea. Asset prices appreciate, everyone feels wealthier. Then as interest rates rise, issues arise with servicing debts, and then you start to get the challenges with inflation continuing higher, and debt servicing costs rising, financial stress arising. That's when you start to get stagflation, where economic activity starts to peter out, but inflation keeps going. Well, that's probably at some point out there in the future. It doesn't look like it's realistic right now. We're still in the early stages of an inflationary cycle. We haven't seen any effort by central banks to raise rates, and realistically, they can't. They're in a very difficult position, because we've seen this correlation between the median age of the population and bond yields. And I think that's been one of the most profound factors that I think has arisen over the last while. I created this chart earlier in the week. We can clearly see that the countries with the oldest populations have the lowest yields. So how are we going to get to a point where yields can rise with old populations? Well, one would be to reduce the age of the population. So you do that by lots of young immigrants. Of course, that is not politically feasible in a large number of countries. The other thing, of course, would be inflation, or to lengthen the retirement age so that those workers become or stay productive for longer. That would obviously be a more productive use of time. It would be able to enhance the argument for higher interest rates. Unfortunately, that is unlikely to occur outside of a crisis. And the crisis in public finances is building. In the USA, the Social Security Administration is going to run into deficit this year, and it will be completely exhausted of resources within a decade. And that is going to cause a crisis. It will have to be recapitalized. Pensions left and right are really dependent on interest rates to secure their obligations in the future, and they're just not getting them. So they have had to invest in alternatives, and a lot of those alternatives are extremely highly valued. So there is incredible potential from the technology sector, but it's incredibly interest rate sensitive. And this is by far the most important of all questions. Will central banks raise interest rates? They're going to be inhibited from raising interest rates. And inflation is likely to take off and stay high before they raise interest rates. And even then, they will be reluctant to raise interest rates enough to quell inflation, because they have to do something about the quantity of debt outstanding, and inflation is really the only answer. So that suggests that we are in for a boom, that there will be an inflationary boom at the beginning of this new cycle, and that it could result in a significant bull market in just about everything. But eventually, interest rates will have to rise. And at that point, the sectors that are most interest rate sensitive will be under significant challenges. So as we look at the accelerating trends and the consistent trends in the technology sector in particular, and the potential for catch-up plays and transitions and the search, or the, I guess, the grasp for growth transitioning to Asia, well, all of that is going to be dependent on interest rates staying down. And I think that that is quite likely for at least the next few years. It's not really until they have to, not whether they want to, but that central banks will have to raise rates. And it's quite likely that China will be the first country to raise rates. But we're just not there yet. I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.